My name is Ed Goldberg. Welcome to Author Author, an occasional series of conversations with authors touring through Portland or whom I have reached by phone. My name is Ed Goldberg, and I am extremely pleased to be welcoming to All Classical Julia Sweeney. Welcome, Julia.
Thanks for having me here.
Sure. Can I call you Julia?
Yes, you can.
Okay. Now, besides being a renowned person of comic proclivities, you were on Saturday Night Live for how long?
4.5 years.
4.5 years. You've written a couple of books.
Yeah.
You're a cancer survivor.
Yes.
And you are also the adopted mom of a Chinese kid. And we're going to talk a lot about that because that's what your book is about, more or less.
More or less.
Yeah. Title of the book is If It's Not One Thing, It's Your Mother, written by Julia Sweeney, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. Now, one of the things that made me happy to read this book is that I discovered, and I'm not the only one who exists in a sea of ambiguity and neurosis. So there's a lot of that in this book. Would you disagree?
No, I don't disagree.
You're ambivalent about almost everything, which I find myself, the older I get, being more so.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's hard to have really concrete. I mean, there's a lot of different shades to everything.
50 Shades of Grey, for one thing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That actually seems to be very... Not very many shades of gray, actually, but...
Yeah, well, the title is probably better than the content. I don't know. I haven't read the book.
I haven't either. I shouldn't say.
But I know I know what I'm calling my next book already, the title.
What?
It will be Naked Pictures of Justin Bieber.
That is going to be a
hit.
People
will buy it. People will buy it, yes. Okay. Now, let's talk about you. This book contains a lot of personal essays about you and your life, but it really revolves around your relationship with your adopted child and the marriage that took place around the same time. At one point in the book, you mentioned getting out of the game when you were no longer capable of having children because of your cancer. And then suddenly that made you want kids. What was going on with that?
Well... it might have just been a convergence of events. It might be some deep part of my personality that I don't totally understand, where when I can't do something, I want it after I can't do it. But I think you could also argue that it really wasn't that. It was that I had had a lot of success in show business, and then I'd had some failure too, like public failure with the It's Pat movie, and which it was fine with me. I didn't get depressed about that or anything, but I felt like I was weary of show business. Like my drive to succeed in that arena was really strong, and that had a lot of meaning for me. And then it didn't have that much meaning for me anymore. And I realized I wanted to change my life. I wanted to slow down. I was ready to be with a kid, and I wanted a kid, but I was single and I didn't have a uterus. So I was far from my dream.
At least one thing is definitely would stop you from having a child. Being married doesn't really matter anymore. But I have a cousin in town. Actually, it's my wife's cousin, and she has adopted two Chinese girls. One came here at 11 months old, and one came here at 11 years old and didn't speak a word of English. And she's now an American kid in almost every way. She's 18 now, I think.
And wow.
So I know a little bit about what you're going through, you know, going to China and putting up with all the stuff there and meeting the other people. Do you keep up with the people that you went to China with?
We do. Now that I'm in Illinois, they're mostly in California, where it's mostly by email. But one couple I'm still in regular contact with, and their daughter Hazel, who is Mulan's age, she's a film editor, and we see each other at things. I just saw her in New York a few weeks ago. And the other people, we all, on the anniversary of the day we all met our kids for the first day, which was February 23rd, we all send pictures to each other, updating each other on how all the girls are. So,
yeah, we'll talk more about that later, but I do want to talk about the title of the book, If It's Not One Thing, It's Your Mother, which just sounds like a snotty comment, but there's an embroidered pillow involved. Why don't you tell us that story?
Well, my mom, this is like 20 years ago, my mother came to visit me in Los Angeles and brought me this little pillow as a gift that was embroidered. It's a blue, and it's what the cover of the book looks like. It has this embroidery around the outside, and it says, If It's Not One Thing, It's Your Mother. And she thought it was hysterical, and I really didn't think it was hysterical or funny or anything. And I, you know, faked appreciation, and then I put it in the closet and brought it out when she was visiting. And then I had my daughter, suddenly I was a mom, and I was going through this closet, I found the pillow, and it was suddenly hysterical to me. I thought it was just hilarious, and I put it on my daughter's bed, and sure enough, when people toured the house, they would see it and laugh. And then when my daughter was about 7, she came to me with the pillow and said, "This is not funny to me, I don't get it." And I just liked that story, because it was just about an evolving sense of humor and how your perspective changes and how it continues on with the next generation.
Perspective is everything, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the kind of thing a mom would find funny and a kid wouldn't necessarily find
exactly.
funny. Yeah,
I think you have to be the mom with the pillow on your kid's bed in order for it to be funny, not the kid.
Mm-hmm. Now, like a lot of us, you've been through a few failed relationships, as I mm-hmm. suppose that's the best way.
Well, you know what? It's so funny. A lot of people say that, and I don't really look at them as failed relationships. I just look at them as relationships that lasted a certain period of time and didn't last longer. But it's okay. Most people would say failed relationships.
No, I understand that, because I think every relationship has within it its own arc.
Yeah.
And sometimes the arc is your life, and sometimes it's 6 weeks, you know, so. Yeah.
I mean, I think a failed, if you chose someone to be the father of your children, for example, and the provider, and then they didn't do that and they beat you up or something, and you had to leave them, that would be a failed choice.
Mm-hmm.
But in my experience, my relationships were, I wasn't relying on a man for that, and we were together and there was no big agenda, and so they kind of ran their course and ended and people went on. So I don't think of them as necessarily failures, just sort of, but anyway, but that's what most people say.
Yeah. Well, no, that's fine. And I was thinking, you've named them all Joe. Joe is
yes.
your generic name you've assigned to all of them. And I'm
yeah.
reading this and I'm saying, so happiness is not a thing called Joe.
Yes, that's funny. That is so funny. If I had thought of that before, I would have put that in the book. That is really funny.
Feel free to put it in the next edition.
I can't. The book is done.
Oh, okay. Yeah, when it's done, it's done.
I
know that.
I can't put that in.
One of the funniest stories in here is the passive-aggressive sinister sweater. You need
yes.
tell that story.
Well, I had a boyfriend that I was really, you know what, I was really crazy about him, but really it was more the timing for me, I think, than the person. In a lot of ways now, I realize how inappropriate of a partner he would be for me for a lifetime. He was great for that time. But I suddenly wanted to have a family, and he was the guy I was in love with, and I decided to start knitting him a sweater. And he already had a kid, and he was divorced, and he was completely uninterested in having a kid or getting married. And I don't know why I didn't just believe that. He told me that. I didn't listen to that. But I decided to knit him a sweater, and mostly it was trying to, I was having kind of a domestic surge, and I wanted to do things like learn to knit, and I decided to knit him the sweater, and I knit, and it took me almost a year to knit the sweater, and every time I thought of bringing up the idea of marriage or children, I just quelled that desire and put it all into my knitting. And then after a year, I describe in this book this kind of harrowing story where I fly up, I'm meeting him in Idaho where his family lived. And I give him the sweater, and he's appreciative, and everybody likes the sweater. And then the next day at a Perkins restaurant under fluorescent lights, he breaks up with me. And it's just devastating. And even though now when I recount it, I was so naive and blind to what was really going on and how that sweater just represented, you know, I think I say in the book, it was like a noose around his neck. And with every knit and purl, I was tightening it. For me, it felt like it came out of the blue. I was really depressed after this breakup, and I really couldn't. I actually had the first, I would say, true. Well, I don't like to say depression because I don't really suffer from depression, but I can get sad for a really long time.
You know, you can be depressed because something bad happens. It's just that, you
right.
know, it's not your
right.
whole.
It's not. Like, it was event related
yeah.
sadness that lasted about 9 months or so, where I really couldn't get off the couch. I was watching a lot of television, and I changed my life, actually, in a lot of different ways. It turned out to be a great time, actually, mm-hmm. even though at the time it was a terrible time.
Well, you seem to be doing fine now, so I'm happy to say that. It's interesting. I thought that you had put your entire nesting instincts and home, you know, the homebody thing into the sweater, because that it represents so much. If you really think about it, a handcrafted project from your own hands, and you know, all this
right,
kind of
exactly.
stuff.
No, I think you've got to really pick the right person for your knit sweater, and I think a baby is the right person for
a baby's,
sweater.
Yeah,
first of all, it's a lot faster. because yes. they're smaller.
Socks are faster,
and
too.
And socks. Yeah. Scarf. Something like that.
Yeah. I knew somebody that was knitting a scarf, and she did it only when she was feeling poorly, you know, depressed.
Uh-huh.
And the scarf, when she finally finished, it was about 84 feet long. And
oh, my God.
It was not really a scarf. It was a project, you know.
Right.
And that's what she did.
It is really satisfying, though, knitting. Yeah. In fact, now I still take knitting classes with my daughter, and I knit a lot now.
There was a factoid that came out of this book that I found interesting, that European knitting style is different from
yes.
American knitting style.
Yes, it is. I don't know why, because the American knitting style is absolutely crazy. It involves like 10 times more work. Like you pick up your whole arm and you scoop, you know, like you loop the yarn around the needle and then put it in, when you could really just sneak behind it and grab. I don't know. Knitters know about it, but it's really curious how the Americans came up with their style. It's really nutty.
I blame the Protestant ethic.
Yes, we'll do something. Yeah. We'll make it take a lot more time.
That's right. I mean, you have to suffer while you're doing it.
Yes.
I'm using the phrase that you used here, although the phrase has come up before in the world. The barren ant syndrome. That is so... I almost cried when I read that. But why did you think of yourself as the barren aunt?
Well, because I had three really wonderful aunts when I was growing up. My Aunt Barbara, my Aunt Bonnie, and my Aunt Shirley. And they were all women who chose not to have children. And I say they're barren aunt, but I don't know if they're barren. You know, like I just know that they're career women. And they really put a lot of energy and love into us kids, their nieces and nephews, my whole family. And I benefited so much from them. And I really identified with them more than I did with my own mom. Like not that I didn't love my mom, but I liked the idea that they were in these relationships that didn't have to include kids, that they were dedicated in their careers. They mostly lived in had a bigger view of the world. They did things like go to museums and see foreign
travel, yeah.
Like everything about it. And then I also had such special relationships with each one of them, and it really transformed me. And I identified with that. I saw myself more in that kind of role than I did necessarily being a mom.
Having assigned yourself that role, you quickly decided that one way to get out of it would be to adopt a child.
I know, it's true.
No, well, and I'm glad that you did, because, you know, I don't have any kids. And mm-hmm. my wife and I made that decision a long, long time ago that we weren't going to be parents. And yet we have nieces and nephews up the wazoo, and we have our cousins' little girls from China. Mm-hmm. So there's kids around us constantly. And that's nice, because it's like renting a kid.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, you get a kid for a little while, you take it to the movies,
right.
you know, you go out and have a pizza,
right.
and then they go home and make their mess at home.
And you can kind of pick and choose a little bit.
Yes, you
can. You don't have to love all of them.
That's right. Even though you want to, you don't have to. Yeah.
Right.
So you made some paradigm shift happen
yes.
in your mind. And this was a time when a lot of people were adopting girls
yeah.
from China. So tell us about the process, and I really want to know about the emotional music, too.
Oh, yes. Well, at the time, and I think it's a little bit different now, but for a single woman, well, first of all, for me, it was really important the kid be as healthy as possible. And I feel guilty about saying that that's what I wanted, but I felt like there was enough things in life that could go wrong. You don't know about anyone, even a kid that you have, what kind of mental state you're going to be dealing with. And I just felt like starting with the healthiest kid you possibly could. And that really meant China, because they didn't discriminate against single people. Single people had as equal chance as married couples to adopt. It was open. That has actually changed since then. But at the time, it was open. And the kids were very healthy. They have the one-child policy there, and they Chinese prefer boys because they take care of the parents in old age. So there was a lot of girls abandoned, but they were healthy for the most part. And so that was just an ideal choice for me. So I chose this company in Los Angeles who arranged those kinds of things. And it took a couple of years, and there was a lot of paperwork, but it was actually fairly easy. They kind of told you everything to do, and you had to get social workers to sign off on your house and on your mental health and those kinds of things. But it was generally easy. And then we went with a group. There was about 40 adults. Actually, no, that's not. Yeah, there was 19 babies and about 40 adults. We all went to China. They all took us into a ballroom. They herded us onto one side, and then they would call your name and you'd go to the other side of the room. And then from behind that person's head, Norman, the guy who organized the adoptions, would come out with a baby held up over his head. So basically, the crowd sees the baby before you do, which is a little disconcerting. And then they also said they were going to play, and they told us they were going to play emotional music. And the emotional music they chose was the theme to the Titanic. Yes.
This is like a game show.
I know. It really, it had a game show quality.
That's scary. I mean, all they needed was Vanna with the wheel. You know?
I know, exactly.
Yeah. Well, couple number six, you're going to get run the wheel. This baby.
I know.
I'd like to remind our listeners I'm speaking with Julia Sweeney. I'm really thrilled to meet you, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
The title of her book is If It's Not One Thing, It's Your Mother, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. Now, having gotten the baby, and again, the baby's name was Mulan. You added
yes.
an American name pick for it, but Mulan is what you chose to call the baby, and I'm glad you did. But everybody is going to think that you named it after a Disney princess.
I know. Well, she was named Mulan at the orphanage. That wasn't, who knows what her intended original name was, but at the orphanage they named her Mulan, which means strong and beautiful. Mu means strong, Lan means beautiful, and that's a beautiful name, and it fits her. Mm-hmm. She is strong and beautiful. The Disney movie had just come out the year before, and I just could not have a baby that was named Mulan and live in Hollywood where people would think it was the only name I could think of. So I named her Tara Mulan. I kept Mulan as a middle name. But when she was about three, we were at a park. She would never say her name. Like, people would say, "What's your name?" And she would just look at them blankly. Like, and I thought, it took her a long time to understand. Like, she responded to Tara when I called her name, but she wouldn't say Tara. So we were in a park, and this man said, "What's your name, little girl?" And I said, "It's Tara." And she said, "Mulan." And then she looked at me like, "You can call me Tara, but I answer to Mulan." And so then from that, and it was it. Okay, fine, you're Mulan. She didn't really understand. I didn't know if I was supposed to protect her from her own name or just let her have it. I decided to let her have it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when my cousin's baby came over from China, her name was Jinmei. And Alyssa is the American name that my cousin had chosen for. I'm admitting something here. That if she listens to this, she's going to kick me in the butt. But I made a concerted effort personally to keep calling the baby Jinmei.
Oh.
And now she is known as Jinmei.
Oh, really?
Yes. And I did it because I thought this is what she has from China.
Right.
This is her cultural heritage in two little words. And I really hope that she gets at least to keep that part of it.
Right.
So,
yeah.
And of course, when the older one was adopted, she was 11
yeah.
years old. You
so
know,
she had a name.
She had a name. Exactly.
And what's her
right.
name?
Shinshu.
Shinshu. Okay, so that's kind of a hard name.
It is, yeah.
For an American, yeah.
And with X's, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So, but it would have been better to be Jinmei and Shinshu than Alyssa and Shinshu when the two
right.
girls are clearly
yeah.
Chinese, you know.
Right,
so,
exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
So I did it on purpose. There, I've gone and admitted it.
Yes.
You hired a nanny. Now, this is the stuff of comedy routines and horror films.
Right.
And yours fits into both in a little bit,
yes.
doesn't it? Yeah. Describe the process of hiring the nanny.
Well, first there was a person who could get you a Chinese nanny. They could even get nannies from the province your child was born in. I mean, it's all a market. The whole thing's just a big market, which is fine. But she brought over many people to apply, and there was a couple who was really, you know, stern. They were going to do the job together. There was a Chinese doctor who was here illegally, and I felt bad for her, but I had to have a legal person because I was going to travel out of the country and need the nanny to come with me. So I had to have a legal resident. And then I found Lisa, who was fantastic. And she was with me for about two or three years. And then she opened her own daycare center, so she left. But Lisa was great, and she spoke Chinese with Mulan, who never responded in Chinese but understood everything she said. And then after her, I had another nanny that I called the Chinese Pat because she was completely androgynous, and she was mistaken for a man most of the time. And I actually really liked her, but she turned out to have a drinking problem, and she totaled my car with Mulan in it, possibly.
Yeah.
So that was difficult. And then I had a guy who was half Chinese and half Irish, which I thought was great. It was like if Mulan and I had a child together, it would be this guy. But then that didn't work out either. And then finally, I stopped trying to get specifically Chinese nannies.
Mm-hmm. And how's it working out?
Well, now we don't have anyone
oh,
because
okay.
she's, you know, 13 and she doesn't really need
a course,
babysitter.
Yeah. 13 years old now.
Yeah.
I mean, I tend to think of her as this child, but
yes.
She's not a kid anymore,
no.
Really.
Yeah.
I'm 13, you know.
Yes.
Okay, now I make notes as I go through the book, and the note for this, I hope you pick up, is Arden and the Ethiopian adoption.
Oh, yes. Well, I had a dog adopt me then. He came and started sleeping on my porch. I did not want a dog. I felt I had enough. I had cats. I did not want a dog. And through many weeks of trying to find someone to take this dog that needed a huge amount of exercise and was not house trained in any way, not particularly people friendly, very aggressive with strangers, a lot of problems with this dog, nipped at the heels of children, not good for kids. Yeah, no, terrible. But he won my heart. And I finally let him in. And during this time, I'm doing this Ethiopian adoption because I wanted to do I want to have two kids. And Ethiopia boys seemed to be at the bottom of the list at that time. And I felt a lot of compassion for them. And I wanted to do it. So I was in the middle of that. But I had this moment where I think I'm going to Spokane and I have to get the dog in a kennel and Mulan and the stroller and all this stuff. And I realized that I just can't do it. I really just can't do it on my own. I can't have two kids and a dog and a cat and a house and work. And so basically the dog replaces the other sibling.
Yeah, it occurs to me just listening to you talk that you're a bleeding heart, number one.
I know.
And then
I'm
you
trying
always,
not to be now. I'm trying always, to go to the other side and be tough.
No, yeah, you're tough. and you always take the burden, you know, the worst burden you can find and take it on yourself. An ugly, mean dog.
An ugly, mean dog.
And an Ethiopian boy to adopt.
I know it. But I know it is kind of funny because for a long time I thought, well, it's really true because even with my husband now, everyone, well, he was not like my husband was a found lost person. Well,
or an ugly mean dog.
If you were here and say, yes, I was a lost person who needed to be found. but it was definitely kind of a haphazard put together family situation.
Aren't they the best kind, though?
Yeah, no, I like that. Mm-hmm. To me, that's more romantic in my mind than any other way.
You know, everybody gets the family that they don't ask for. You're just born into a family, but the family you accumulate around you.
Yes.
And the relatives you choose to stay in touch with, you know, that's your family.
It's true.
Yeah,
yes,
okay.
That's true.
All right, now that's my dime store philosophy for the day. tell us about meeting Michael.
Well, I was working on Desperate Housewives as a writer, and I had done an excerpt on This American Life, the Ira Glass's NPR show or PRI show. And I was getting lots of email response to it. It was this thing called Letting Go of God, or what became Letting Go of God. It was kind of an early version of it. And so I was getting hundreds and hundreds of emails in response to it. And one of the emails had the headline, Desperately Seeking Sweeney-in-Law. And the first lines were, I'm writing to you to propose marriage to you on behalf of my brother, who doesn't know I'm writing to you. I'd propose to you myself, but I'm gay and I live in San Francisco, so I don't think it would work out between us. But you are the woman for my brother. And then it went on to describe his brother and his crazy family. And it was a very funny letter. But I didn't respond to it. I wanted to respond to him and say, nice letter, but I'm not going to meet your brother. Like, please. But I just ended up not responding. Several months later, I ran into a woman in New York after a show I was doing there who said, my friend wrote you a letter proposing marriage on behalf of his brother. And I said, oh, yeah. And she said, I just want to vouch for those two brothers. I've known them since high school for 30 years now. They're very funny. And it was just this funny conversation. And then 9 months after that, I was doing a show in LA and I came out to the lobby and there was a handsome, tall guy standing there. And he said, I wrote you a letter about a year ago proposing marriage on behalf of my brother. And I said, oh, right. You know, I'm sorry I never wrote him or something. And he said, no, I'm glad you didn't write him because he's a jerk. And I said, what? And he said, well, when he found out I wrote that letter, he got so angry and now we aren't speaking and my whole family's mad at me about the letter. And in fact, my mother came to see your show and she won't even meet you. She's like over on the other side of the lobby. I said, oh my gosh, I have to meet the mother. So I went over and met the mother and she was really funny. And so I wrote to Michael, the brother, just to say, don't be mad at your brother. It's all okay. And then he wrote back, his headline was, I am mortified. You cannot imagine the mortification I felt when I found out this letter had been sent to you with my cell phone number and a picture of me. And then I wrote back and he wrote back and one thing led to the other. And then we got married.
Excellent.
That's how it happened.
Mazel tov.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So I'm thinking that this is tangential to the book because you don't really bring it up much in the book. But you did come out as an atheist at some point.
Yes.
And I was one of the people that stood on the sidelines and cheered because, but it occurs to me, like, I'm a Jewish atheist, you're a Catholic atheist, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yet there's some things you just can't let go.
No,
and
I still
it colors
say
your atheism.
Yes. I'm culturally Catholic, and that's something I'll never not be. And I like being. I actually like going to Mass still occasionally.
The spectacle is fabulous.
No, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
And the ritual of the Mass is really beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I believe in God as a metaphor. Like, to me, God is a metaphor. It's a great metaphor. And I stand up for God as a metaphor. but I like people to acknowledge that it's a metaphor. Mm-hmm. But I really couldn't be Catholic anymore because I have a lot of problems with the church that just in many, many ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Because I know a lot of Catholics who are atheists who still go to church and are part of churches. And I think that's fine, too. And I totally empathize with that. But I can't do that. I just can't. I disagree too much and too deeply. But I do like community. I do like ritual. I do like singing with people. I think all those things are of value. So I'm sympathetic to that more than like my husband, who's a third generation Jewish atheist. Like when I didn't know till I met my husband about this whole other culture that his family's in of like Jewish atheist, socialist / communist who went to summer camps, like socialist summer camp is what Michael's parents went to growing up. Like they were Jewish, but it wasn't like they just stopped being Jewish. They were Jewish atheists and proud of it and in a big tradition. Yes, Leandra. Oh, no. When Michael was 8, his family went to Mexico.
To meet Trotsky?
No, they didn't meet, but they went to see where he was shot. Like, these were the people they emulated. They're super progressive socialists. Very, you know, Michael grew up going to protest marches for things. Very outspoken and also very Jewish, although they practice no rituals. Like, he wasn't bat mitzvah or anything. It's not even...
Oh, really?
Nothing.
Not even that, huh?
No, nothing.
And, wow.
And very proud about it, too. Mm-hmm. We do not do any of those things. But they are ethnically Jewish, and the family kept marrying other ethnically Jewish people. And so... But third generation, I mean, that's pretty impressive.
In fact,
the first thing Norma said to me is, we are third generation atheists. And we are proud of
that. And thank God for that, yes.
I know. And I said, well, great.
I didn't come from a family of atheists, but I came from a family of fairly free thinkers. And I do walk around with a Leon Trotsky button on my jacket.
I love that.
Yeah. And besides, if you give up God totally, what are you going to say when you hit your thumb with a hammer?
See, you need something.
You need something. You really do. Okay. Speaking of all this kind of stuff, this is, you know, again, peripheral to the God thing, but this book has two of the funniest Santa Claus tooth fairy stories that I've ever heard involving Mulan. You got to tell the stories about
that. Well, they're more elaborate in the book, of course, but the shorthand version of the story is that, you know, when I adopted Mulan, you know, I liked Santa Claus growing up. I loved Christmas. I loved all of it. I don't know when I stopped believing in Santa Claus, but it was kind of young and it was not traumatic. And I wanted to have my kid participate in that. But when it came to the act of doing it, meaning looking into a kid's face and lying to them, I could not do it. I mean, like, I actually don't know how parents do it. I don't know how you look at a kid and say, there's a guy out there. Anyway, so I just didn't do it and I was able to miss it. She wasn't in preschool. She didn't really see Santa Claus was like art at a certain time of the year. But then when she turned 4, I changed my mind completely and thought she's missing out on this wonderful part of her culture. She needs to participate in it. And plus, she's going to go to school and kids are going to talk about it. So I decided to tell her. But I waited until Christmas Eve because I didn't know how to tell her. And we were alone that year in LA. And I took her aside on Christmas Eve and I said, Mulan, there is a man who's been watching you. And noticing whether you're good or bad. And she just gave me this horrified look. And I said, and based on your behavior, he's going to bring gifts. And I think you've been good, by the way. And she was like, while we're asleep, this guy's coming in our house. So she got totally traumatized. It was not fun. It was not beautiful. It was horrible. And every time she would see Santa, she got very upset. But then she kind of got used to it. Then the tooth fairy, then she loses a tooth. And so then I had to go through the same thing where I had to say, there's a lady who is going to come in your bedroom while you're sleeping. She's like, what are you talking about? I go, yeah. And she's going to reach under your pillow. And Mulan's like, while I'm asleep? I said, yeah, sure. And take your tooth and leave some money for you. And then I hadn't thought about the money. Anyway, that traumatized her. It was just all a disaster.
I don't blame her at all. This is, when you think, I've never thought about it that way, but that's absolutely the right way to think about it in many ways. Yeah.
Like, what do you mean someone's coming in my bedroom that I don't know while I'm asleep?
Yes, I'm reaching under my pillow.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, you tell, I mean, you know, all of this is part of our folklore, but when you look at it from that way, and you know, from that perspective, it's scary.
Yes.
And I thank Mulan for that perspective. I really do. Her perspective is everything. Right?
Yes.
Neither of the two little Chinese girls that I know well are like this, but they have friends that are. There is a little girl, Chinese syndrome, which I call the queen bee. To be the you know, who does everything, who dominates everything, who controls everything. Mulan sounds like she has a little bit of that.
Yeah, I would say there are definitely times where she's like that. I mean, that's partly being an only kid.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's partly her personality, but she's also not like that a lot of the time too. So I think she's a mix.
Okay. Now Mulan wrote an essay on ancestry.
Yes.
I found this totally charming. Let's finish up the interview with that.
Okay.
Tell us a story about that essay.
Well, I think she was in fourth grade. It's the traditional thing they do in that school district where they talk about immigration and they talk about how America's filled with immigrants. And unless you're a Native American, your family came here from somewhere recently. And so you were supposed to go home and talk about your ancestry. And I realized that I had sort of deliberately not talked about my ancestry or Michael's ancestry very much. Like, we didn't talk about grandparents because when you have an adopted kid, it's hard to, you know, like, know if that's like making them feel like they're not part of it or is it including them? I don't really know. But I just didn't talk about it very much. But she was very interested in this project. So she interviewed me and wrote down all these facts. And she interviewed Michael and wrote down all these facts. And then when I read her essay, I was so moved by it because she saw herself as an immigrant in a long line of immigrants, of people who come together and create a family. She had no problems feeling like she was part of both of these families and that she had a right to be there as an immigrant who came into this family. And so I liked that, and I ended up putting it in the book.
Yeah, this book is really wonderful because it's funny, it's moving, it's interesting because, I mean, I learned about European knitting, which I didn't
yes.
know before. Yeah,
yes, that's very important.
It's full of little things like that and big things, too. One of the things that I found very sly about this book is that it managed to talk about very big things in a kind of a folksy, you know, one-to-one way. And
thank you.
Well, you know, you did it. It's a good job. Thank you so much for coming here.
Thank you. This has been nice. Very, very nice. Like a refreshingly nice, I have to say.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Title of the book is If It's Not One Thing, It's Your Mother. It's written by Julia Sweeney, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. I hope you come back again.
I will.
You've been listening to Author, Author, produced at the studios of All Classical KQAC-FM in Portland. My name is Ed Goldberg. You can find these programs at our website, allclassical.org/author. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back soon.